It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
My name is Jamil, and I organize with Arizona Palestine Solidarity Alliance.
Some of y'all came on the podcast before, but we wanted to kind of come back and expand some of the stuff that we were talking about the last time. Just to start off, I mean, I think we need to kind of almost dive into kind of a crash course in the history of the occupation of Palestine. I know that could be like its own thing, but can we kind of unpack that and talk about the history?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really important context for what we're going to discuss in the meat of this. In preparation, I kind of had to give myself a little bit of a crash course too, because while I'm Palestinian, it's still like so many events happened during that time. But I'll do my best to sort of condense it. And I'm obviously not a historian or an academic or anything like that, so I'll try and get as much right as I can. So prior to the 1900s, Palestine and the Arab Palestinians sort of had a rotating cast of occupiers. You've got your Crusaders, your Ottomans, but it was the British, that really sort of kicked this into motion. And Palestine has always had a majority indigenous Arab population, going back generations. Jews, Christians, and Muslims have always called Palestine home, but kind of in more recent centuries, Christians and Jewish folks have sort of been like a very vibrant minority in that area. Especially because you've got Jerusalem there, and that's, your three holy sites for each religion. But you also had a lot of other like diaspora minorities there, like Armenians and Kurds and Bedouins. But anyway, in 1917, you have something called the Balfour Declaration, which is established by the British. And the whole idea of that is to support a Jewish state in historic Palestine. So this is like World War One era that we're talking about. And this is the first major world power to publicly support the wishes of early political Zionism. And if you sort of fast forward a little more into there, you get into the year before Israel's creation, 1947. At this point, you have an increasing number of Jewish folks, mostly from Europe, who've begun settling in Palestine, sort of trickling in little by little as Zionism becomes like more of a prominent sort of project. And of course, you have all the anti-Semitic horrors, persecution, and genocide that have been taking place in Europe. So it's not without good reason, of course. So these early Jewish folks that are settling in Palestine sort of begin organizing themselves into what's documented as like very insular communities. Which is obviously alarming the Palestinian Arabs who are living there. And a lot of these folks are even butting heads with like the native Jewish populations that are living there, because, while they're both Jewish, there is quite a big cultural difference. And also the way in which they're settling is incredibly, forceful. So you also have the formation of like these right-wing nationalistic, Zionist militias, which really, set the stage in settling the land. And of course, the most effective way to settle some land is through the barrel of a gun. And, one of these most notorious militias is called the Irgun. And these guys were responsible for bombing a King David Hotel in Jerusalem, which killed like, I think, close to 100 people, mostly tourists. But their main target was the administrative headquarters for Britain. And this gave like the British a really, really good scare and sort of sped up their pullout from Palestine, which is what they were planning on doing all along. So Israel kind of needed the support of the British to create their state. But once they got their ethnic cleansing project of the Palestinians underway, a lot of these like really right-wing militias began to threaten the British forces so that they could like assume full control without like having a little colonial watchdog which is like really funny and bizarre, because from the very beginning, Israel is like inherently a settler colonial project, right? You know, that's been promoted by the two most notorious settler nations of modern history, you know, Britain and the U.S. So now we're at 1948, and this is the big date in all this. The UN basically adopts Resolution 181, which is a partition plan for Palestine, which the Palestinians reject. And there's basically four numbers here that you have to sort of, that really like, you know, sort of like make you understand what's going on here. This partition project is basically saying, we want to give 55% of the land to the Jews, and we give 45% of the land to the Palestinians. You know, which seems almost like half and half split. But the big thing here is that 70% of the population of that entire land is Arab majority, and then 30% of that land is Jewish, and mostly recent sort of people trickling in. So, of course, Palestinians are going to reject this. It's completely unfair. And ultimately, a lot of the world powers align, and the state of Israel is created under this resolution. And this sparks outrage from, you know, the Middle East and North Africa, because it throws the geopolitics of the entire region off. And another thing is, like, it upsets a lot of the pan-Arab, mostly socialist type movements, which themselves have been victims of colonization. So, you know, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, which are, you know, two of the biggest powers, recognize Israel immediately, like, the day of. And it's a little bit of like a we're in charge of the world and whatever we say goes type mentality. So Israel's created. The mass settling of Jewish people into Palestine is what Palestinians, what we call al-Nakba, which is an Arabic word, which means catastrophe. And this is defined by the ethnic cleansing of Palestine by the Israeli army. Basically militias that are kind of the proto-IDF. And this is a very important period between 1947 and 1950. And like the scale of al-Nakba is like pretty huge. Like, over 80% of Palestinians in what became Israel were basically expelled outside of their villages and towns. So you got 80% of Palestinian land seized by Zionist forces. You've got 750,000 to 1 million is the estimate. That's the number of Palestinians expelled and made refugees by these paramilitaries. And then you've got more than 400 Palestinian towns, villages, cities that were destroyed by Israeli forces, and then either destroyed and left alone or repopulated.
The popular imagination, I think how this plays out in the way a lot of people talk about this conflict, is that, oh, it's just a bunch of religions over there. They've always hated each other. Like, it's just like, you know, one side likes peanut butter and the other side likes chocolate or whatever, you know, like it's really just about, you know, some stuff that they, you know, goes back forever. And really, I mean, it's about basic stuff that everybody can understand. I mean, it's about people being forced off their land, and we're going to talk about how that continues today, but I just kind of wanted to point that out.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, like, pre 1948 Palestine is like a really good example of how like people of the three monotheistic faiths like can live together really peacefully, like, you know. So I mean, that narrative is utter. I mean, it's just a way to distract from like the root causes that I just went over.
How does this continue to this day? I mean, Israel is still, I mean, literally destroying people's homes. Like, it will just come into an area and be like, you know, hey, we're gonna bulldoze your house today.
Yeah.
How does that play out?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you know, those stats that I went over with, like, all of the 400 villages and towns destroyed, you know, and it ended up displacing a lot of people, not only outside of Palestine, but also, like, it displaced a lot of people outside of, like, their village and into another part of Palestine. So, you know, they might be in the same area, like, general vicinity. I mean, Palestine's not a big country. But they're now in like this new village, and they're with a lot of other refugees, and things are very desperate. But yeah, you're right. This still happens all the time. I mean, homes are bulldozed for all kinds of reasons. And, you know, this is all subject to Israeli law and will and whim. And it's generally a military decision that's, coordinating with like whatever the Israeli bureaucracy is. You know, there's obviously no accountability from like the world, from the UN, and the US self, like, supports Israel, like, full stop, and pretty much guarantees that these types of atrocities can like continue.
You know, one other kind of overarching question, you know, Americans, when they think about, you know, and this is kind of in the popular imagination of just like freedom and living in a free society, you know, they think about the ability to like get in your car and go somewhere, go to the store, hang out with your friends. I think so much of what kind of defines, at least from what I've seen watching documentaries and talking to people that have gone over there or have family members that live there or have lived there themselves, is just the control of movement and how people have to constantly pass through checkpoints and how policed society is and just how much control literally the state has on where you can go and what you can do. Can you just talk about what everyday life in Palestine is like for Palestinians that are living in the occupied territories?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, current day, you've got basically three categories, broad categories of Palestinians. You have the ones who are living in the West Bank, you know, which is occupied territory. You have folks who are, and that's where the famous, you know, infamous wall is constructed to separate the West Bank from, you know, Israel proper. And then you've got your Gaza Strip, which is, you know, as described as an open air prison. And, you know, is you know, definitely the most dire of all the situations. And then you have your third category of Palestinians who are like considered Israeli citizens, but really are second class citizens, like living amongst, you know, Israeli society. But in the West Bank, like if I'm to speak to that particular area, like the wall was basically built and carved in to like really devastate like Palestinian life. A lot of the reasoning that you hear from Israel and other sort of reactionary people is that like the wall was constructed to, stop all like, you know, suicide bombs or attacks within Israel. And, it had a lot of other purposes to it as well. And it also, doesn't acknowledge that became a tactic that was thrown out, you know, in the second Intifada after a while. But like the wall is devastating because it's like you're saying, it's a huge reduction in the freedom of travel within the country. There's an insane amount of IDF checkpoints and road closures. These are all obviously very dehumanizing checkpoints. I mean, a lot of times people have guns pointed like squarely at them, like at all times. You're searched, strip searched, barked at. The wall also creates a lot of other problems for Palestinians, like the loss of land to develop. So it's basically Palestinians are stuck with a very finite amount of land to develop, and even then they have to get Israeli permits in order to do it. There's increased difficulty in like accessing like medical and educational services in Israel that are not existent in Palestine because of the dire economic situation and lack of funding coming in. You got restricted access to like water. Obviously, family separation. If you got folks on, you know, other sides of the wall, like let's say your cousins live in Bethlehem and you live in Ramallah, like you don't see each other, you know, even though you're 20 miles apart. And then I think another important area is like the stifling of like popular uprising and resistant movements. It fragments Palestinians living in different cities to be able to get together in a common way to like resist, right? And I think a lot of the same like border tactics or border militarization that Israel has perfected are like being looked at here, you know, in a way that, you know, would want to implement them like at our borders here.
Yeah, I just think people kind of gloss over the fact that like even just to go to get gas or go to work, you might have to pass through checkpoints. It could take hours and hours. I mean, it's essentially, as a lot of people have described, it's like an open air prison. With yeah. lots of armed guards, and like you said, I mean, just a brutal force. I mean, there's a pretty well known anarchist group over there, Anarchists Against the Wall, that has been involved in supporting just ongoing protests against the apartheid wall. And I mean, you know, lots of people get shot at all the time. People die. There's one anarchist in the Bay Area that has been, you know, hit with an Israeli tear gas canister, and they've, you know, their whole body has suffered. And yeah, it's horrible, and people are getting shot all the time and being killed by the Israeli Defense Forces.
Yeah, I mean, they don't distinguish, you know, at all. Like a lot of like folks from Anarchists Against the Wall and other like you know, Jewish leftist groups that oppose the occupation, like actually take part in some of these like Friday like resistance protests that happen every Friday in different small villages in the West Bank, like Baleen and also Nabi Saleh, where like Ahad Tamimi is from, family is from. And they get shot at and tear gassed just like the rest of them. And I mean, it's really tough to be a leftist, like an open leftist in Israel these days, because it's just that world has shrunk. Like there used to be like a healthy active left, and now it's like you will get like it's like a scarlet letter to be a leftist over there. So I have a lot of respect for the folks that are like very active.
And again, I think that's important to point out, because there's this kind of idea within the popular American imagination that Israel is, you know, the one democracy in the Middle East, you know, like our one friend, like a bastion of freedom and free speech.
I don't
recall
apartheid being a facet of democracy.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, of course. But we're going to turn now and kind of look at some other aspects of just the connections between what's going on in occupied Palestine and the U.S., especially along the border. But first, again, like, what does the U.S. get out of this relationship with Israel that's lasted for so long? We're going to talk about kind of like funds and technology and the connection to different corporations in a bit, but just kind of broadly speaking, what's in it for the U.S. to be so well aligned with Israel?
Yeah, I think that there's quite a few reasons, and they've kind of changed a little bit over time. I mean, some of them have remained the same as well. You know, Israel's role is like a strategic asset, you know, like I quote unquote that in sort of just like defense speak. You know, it was like a proxy versus Iran and other sort of like squabbling and imperialist sort of adventures. I mean, I'd say that's number one, is just having like a little brother watchdog. Like a very common saying is like, oh, Israel's like, you know, America's little brother, like just hanging out in the Middle East. And I think, you know, there's some other reasons, like sympathy for the Jewish diaspora and corresponding history of anti-Semitic persecution is most certainly a reason, you know, why their support. Another big reason is like Christian evangelicals' obsession with Israel and end times prophecy. Like, we might look at that stuff and think it's really silly, but like Christian Zionism, like evangelical Christian Zionism is a massive movement here in the U.S. And it's like right alongside groups like Israel lobbying groups like AIPAC, like the most influential sort of resource and arm on like our politicians and sort of dictating a lot of policy in that part of the world. And then the other big thing that I think we'll get into later is like the impact of arms sales and U.S. military industrial complex. And I think that is a massive reason why we are so invested in Israel and why we give them so much aid and money. Because in a lot of ways, it's a return on investment for us. Like we make a lot of money from that.
Yeah. To your point, if people want to explore, there's a facet of evangelical Christianity called Dominionism. And if you look that up, that kind of, it goes along with what you're saying. But I mean, there's a couple facets to it. I mean, especially the belief that basically like literally like Christians have dominion over the earth. Like, you know, basically the earth is here for us to use as a resource and everything that kind of goes along with that. But also it's really tied up in, like you were saying, kind of like these end time prophecies, like Book of Revelation stuff. And I mean, they really believe that having like a strong relationship with Israel is important, and that basically their role is to put into place the things that will cause the Book of Revelations to play out and Jesus to return and all that stuff. And central to that is Israel, which, like you were saying, is, you know, creating foreign policy off that is, you know, is terrifying. But I encourage people to kind of like go down that rabbit hole, look up Dominionism. People have referred to people like Ted Cruz as a Dominionist. Mm-hmm. There's different podcasts out there. People from like Political Research Associates have written a lot about Dominionism, but definitely something, interesting to go into, especially if you're looking into the world of like far right Christianity. But just moving forward, let's talk about specifically in terms of like funds and aid, like from the U.S. to Israel. How much are we talking about? And, you know, is it just money? Is it also other stuff too? But kind of like, what is the U.S. giving Israel in terms of funds, maybe military equipment or anything else?
Yeah, this is super important in understanding like the relationship. So Israel's annual defense budget is $15 billion. The most recent package was signed by Obama. That $38 billion in aid to Israel over the course of 10 years, I think that was signed in 2016. So it's going to, you know, go forward until 2026. So you're looking at $3.8 billion per year in U.S. taxpayer dollars to a country that doesn't need military aid from us. Like, Israel is legit one of the leaders in like war technology. And I think, you know, as in the last, especially the last 15, 20 years, they're up there. They're more advanced in surveillance technology and border technology than we are at this point. I think something like 600, military or border startups are started in Tel Aviv every year, 600. So it's like a burgeoning thing, and we still manage to give them $3.8 billion per year out of our taxpayer dollars. So like there's a really cool resource online. I wish I could remember the exact URL, but it's something like you can determine how much your state gives, how much of your state's budget ends up going to Israel's military aid. And like for Arizona, where we are, it's like $56 million per year. And when you break that down per person, it's like $25 per person just going to Israeli aid. So like, it's kind of a good way to like think about how this, like, literally is money out of your pocket going to this like horrendous, you know, state. And the other thing is like following 9/11, sales of like Israeli, you know, they call them like security exports. It rose from like $2 billion to $7 billion annually. So, there's a big connection between like post 9/11 and Israel and them touting themselves as being experts, in sort of dealing with, you know, quote unquote terrorists. But the U.S. gives most of its military aid through something called the Foreign Military Financing, which is kind of like a line of credit for various technologies. And the terms, like the Foreign Military Financing, like they have this agreement with a lot of countries, obviously a lot of like allies, but like Israel gets a lot of preferential treatment, within this system. Israel can like, buy American weapons just by committing to spending money. And just by committing to spending money in the future. And the U.S. gives Israel its aid right away, while like every other nation can only access American aid if they agree upon an arms purchase. So in that way, like Israel has used American assistance to fund its defense industry, which is, I think, like the eighth largest arms exporter in the world. And there's been a lot of really, really interesting reporting lately, as Israel has sort of like, Israel has, been, exporting to like places like South Sudan and Myanmar, like the state governments there, which we all know as being like incredibly repressive, especially to like any kind of like freedom movement. And the general consensus here is that like, we won't criticize what you're doing in these types of places like Myanmar and South Sudan to like tamp down on your people and like legit commit murder, as long as you don't say anything about what we're doing in the occupation. And like, in fact, we even want you to like kind of cheer for us on the world stage. So like, these things are all like super connected.
We're now going to talk about specifically like corporations. And I mean, specifically like what corporations are doing to basically make the occupation hum. Like, what are they doing that's either facilitating certain things for the Israeli state? And this could be any sort of like corporate contracts or anything they're doing in terms of surveillance or militarization of the police or you know, anything like that. Just curious if you can speak to that.
So the police section is, I mean, I can speak to that after. And that's less corporations and more just, you know, various like, policing unions and sort of like paramilitary sort of like organizations that are making that happen. But in terms of just like straight up, like, border militarization complex, we're talking about weapons manufacturers, surveillance manufacturers, that kind of thing. Like it's kind of good to look at this from like the perspective of the biggest company out there that's sort of, fortifying, and installing tech on our borders here. And it's a company called Elbit Systems. And there was like a brigadier general for the IDF who said something along the lines of like, we've learned a lot from Gaza and Palestine. It's been a great testing laboratory for us. And that's really like the thing that you need to take away from why Elbit Systems is so successful in like this global market. So Elbit is like, it's E-L-B-I-T, is Israel's largest weapons company. They made Israel like the world's leading exporter of military and surveillance drones specifically. Like Israel is absolutely the leader when it comes to military and armed and unarmed drones. So in 2017, they made like over $3 billion in revenue, and they created a subsidiary. There's been a subsidiary of Elbit that's called the Israeli Military Industries, and they produce cruise missiles, cluster bombs, all kinds of really devastating bullets for Israeli snipers. But Elbit's U.S. subsidiary is called Elbit Systems of America, which has like, you know, headquarters like located all throughout the U.S., including like a lot of the Southwest, like Texas, Arizona, California. And what they develop, what they create there are surveillance land vehicles, like I said, drones and accompanying like aerial systems, these things called smart fences, which are branded as IFTs. What that stands for is integrated fixed towers. And I could talk a little more about those. And like other stuff like steel barriers that have the ability to like, you know, like sense whether a person is moving around. The big purchase that happened was in February 2014, where Customs and Border Protection contracted with Elbit to build a virtual wall. And what they mean by that is basically like a technology barrier that cuts through the desert here in Arizona. And Elbit uses that same type of technology in like Israel as well, like especially Gaza and the West Bank, so that they're just constantly monitoring everything. So it's the same tech, it's the exact same technology that was like incubated in Israel is like now being installed here. And our, you know, the DHS looks at that and like goes to these like conferences and sees how like, you know, quote unquote battle tested these things are. It's like, yo, we need that like over here. And so Elbit provides like sensors, cameras, radars, and these IFTs, which are sort of the big ticket items, in the desert, over here. These towers are kind of based on that technology, and they're really renowned in like the military tech industry for being really, really effective, obviously. The towers are obviously built on like a lot of indigenous lands and peoples, like over here, the Tonal of them. Many who have like actively organized against the construction of these border wall towers on their lands. The community definitely knows what's up in terms of like who makes these weapons and the connections to Palestine. You see a lot of that TO Palestine solidarity, which is really inspiring, obviously. But if I can talk a little bit about these IFTs, like this is kind of like the thing that our group has had our eye on the most, I would say.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, they're like these 160 foot surveillance towers, and their capabilities are insane. Like they can monitor every person and vehicle within like up to 8 or 9 miles. They have these cameras with night vision and like thermal sensors, and everything that they collect is like fed into like real-time data to a border patrol agent who's just like sitting behind a desk. So it's very like similar to how drones are operated, you know. And then that system can store and archive with, you know, the border patrol person can just like sit there and like rewind and track individuals' movements. And, I think the thing that you hear a lot is like, if it's, you know, nighttime, it basically, this allows them to like shine a light on the entire border area, right? Just with this single IFT. So it's like, this is highly coveted kind of technology, which, you know, our government has a business relationship with like the American subsidiary of Elbit Systems. So that's kind of like the, I think a good lens to like view, a lot of the technologies and a lot of like the collaboration, corporate collaboration that's happening here.
I was one of the apparatus that downgraded my class status. classroom citizen, touch of human savage. It's hard to fathom, but even harder to manage. I'm a second class citizen in the land of my origin. Forced of origin, a brutal reality that's devoid of humanity. For some semblance of sanity, where truth is profanity. And in all actuality, my right to life is considered a travesty. We can't even bury friends without a threat of the military showing up to carry out the vendetta. A policy of extermination against an indigenous population that's been fighting for emancipation. You wanna end the violence and end the occupation. You wanna see defiance and deny us liberation. This is apartheid Palestine. A sniper fire gets showered from Israeli watchtowers. This is for Haifa. This is for Rafah. This is for Gaza. This is for Balata. This is for Tarek. This is for Bashar. This is for Mahmoud. This is for Tahir. This is for Fatma, who was only 7 and some man shot dead in school at the age of 11. What would you do if you were under occupation? Let them take your freedom and fight for liberation. Come on, call it the freedom fighters of the Intifada, fighting for freedom today, cause there might not be a tomorrow now. Call it the freedom fighters of the Intifada, fighting for freedom today, cause there might not be a tomorrow now. Give me liberty or death, cause I'd rather go out on my feet than on my knees when I take my last breath. If you don't get it, you don't get it. Fighting Zionist oppression doesn't make you anti-Semitic. They say our people won't ever live as one. They say this fight won't ever be done. They say our rights can't ever be won. They say this war won't be undone. They said our people couldn't make it this far. I say they don't know who we are. They say a lot of things, but they only say that mess because they fear the change of organized power brings. We gotta keep it together so we can resist the pressure, but ever organizing to counter oppression, to endeavor to sever the main vein that helps us maintain a state, standing a fight to make change. Don't let your tax dollars go to making people holler, killing off our future scholars with Apache helicopters. Stop that from this racist regime until it redeems the dreams of those that killed midstream. Divest from Israel. Divest from Israel. Divest from the IDF. Divest and let's lay apartheid to rest. Come on, only the freedom fighters of the Intifada fighting for freedom today, cause it might not be a tomorrow. Only the freedom fighters of the Intifada fighting for freedom today, cause it might not be a tomorrow. Won't live the freedom fighters, 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 won't live the freedom fighters of the Intifada fighting for freedom today, cause there might not be a tomorrow. Free, free Palestine.
Well, let's talk specifically about the police. We talked about corporations. I mean, I remember when the Ferguson Rebellion popped off and people in Palestine were like tweeting stuff to people in Ferguson being like, hey, here's some tips on how to deal with tear gas, because we deal with the exact same things. And they were like showing people how to deal with it and like, sharing memes and pictures and stuff like that. But let's specifically talk about the police. You mentioned that there's an overlap there. And for years, the police have been going to Israel to be trained there, and especially be trained in like counterinsurgency and crowd control and like riot control, protest control techniques. What does that look like? I mean, are these just police showing up to conferences, or are the relationships more deep? What kind of stuff are they getting out of this relationship? Is it training, tools, technology? What is it?
It's mostly training, and the most, and there's a few different, like I would say, programs that facilitate these, exchanges. We send our cops over there to train with theirs, and they send theirs over here. What our group has kind of been, most interested in is, looking at local, law enforcement divisions that participate in these. And we try and like catch them if we can before they happen, so that we can apply pressure and like make the community know, like know about it, but a lot of the times we end up finding out like afterwards, because these are very secretive. Like they're not publicized. And it's actually the ADL, which is the Anti-Defamation League, which like, I guess I've heard described as like the NAACP for like Jewish folks. You know, they do a lot of good work, like legit, like, combating anti-Semitism, you know, but with the other hand, they're actually the group that spearheads the most popular and well-known, U.S. Law enforcement and Israel, like, training programs. So like, and this happens every year. So American law enforcement, and when I say like we send cops over there, I don't mean like your typical beat cop on the street. Like they send like, you know, executive assistants to police department, like people who have real leadership, sort of causes, or responsibilities. And so they travel to Israel with the ADL to like study, Israel's tactics and strategies to combat, you know, terrorism, as they say. And this program's called the NCTS, or the National Counterterrorism Seminar. It's usually like about a week or 2 weeks. And it's, you know, the Israeli National Police are there, Israeli intelligence and security people are there, the Israeli Defense Forces are there. So, you know, that's interesting, too, because you have literally like an army training and talking to our police like executives. So when we talk about the militarization of police, in terms of training, like it's very literal, right? They're learning from the IDF. And I think there's been close to like 200 law enforcement executives that have participated in all of these. And I think it started in somewhere in like the early 2000s, like 2002, 2003, after 9/11. These things really, really kicked into gear. And like our group, the good thing is that our group, or any group can, or any individual can actually like access these through public record. So we'll put in public record requests, or we'll rely on other groups. Like Jewish Voice for Peace does like an amazing job, like uncovering a lot of these trainings when they're happening. We've been able to identify by name, you know, local, Phoenix, and Tucson and other cities in Arizona, like police executives that have gone on these trips before. And we can then sort of, you know, as a community, let other folks know about that. And if there are concerns about the militarization of police, which like every police department has those concerns, like we're not out here saying the reason these, police departments are militarized is because they train in Israel. But what we're saying is like, there are specific tactics that have been picked up by these folks, like, in terms of like kettling, like for example, is like a well-known like crowd control tactic that was like made famous by the IDF. And, you know, you see that all the time here, even in situations where things are not even very out of control, you know? And then the other thing I'll bring up in terms of like the relationship between U.S. law enforcement and Israel is, ICE. There's a relationship between ICE and the ADL too. Like, Jewish Voice for Peace, I think, a few years ago, determined that this guy, Peter Edge, who was the acting director for ICE, under Trump, like in the beginning of Trump's presidency, attended a training in Israel as part of the ADL's NCTS program that I just told you about. And so I think Jewish Voice for Peace submitted a FOIA to the Seattle Police Department to uncover that. That's very interesting, too, because what are we outraged about, like, all the time here, like, rightfully so, child separations. Like, what did Peter Edge go and learn from Israel in terms of child separations? Because we know that Israel, every year, like, routinely and without any kind of, like, just cause, imprisons and abducts Palestinian children from their homes, you know, as young as, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old sometimes, so... That's another really, really interesting connection that I think we should kind of be looking more into.
Well, I wanted to turn now and talk about how some of these corporations or technology is being basically transferred from use in Israel and then making its way to the U.S.-Mexican border. And we talked about this kind of last time a little bit, but I really want to kind of dive into this. Basically, how Israel is a laboratory for these kind of repressive technologies, techniques, counterinsurgency methods, and then being used along the U.S. border right now.
Yeah, so like Israel's been doing this obviously for a long time, and I think it's really only like after the 90s and like Operation Gatekeeper and stuff like that, like Clinton and Obama era policies, that like we've developed a real appetite for this stuff. That's sort of the way that like our group and myself analyzes this. So like after 9/11, or I guess in, you know, going back to the 90s, the idea is like the U.S. starts to adopt the idea that like just crossing that line, that borderline, is like a criminal act, right? But then like after 9/11, it kind of like it morphed into something a lot more extreme. The U.S. sort of adopted this idea that crossing that line is now an act of like war or terrorism, right? And I think a big part of the reason was because there's so much manufactured worry about like, Muslim terrorists like coming into the U.S. through the south, through the southern border, and this sort of like precipitated like a massive investment in resources. And this is where like Israel recognized the opportunity, right? Because they've constantly bragging and producing white papers and going to these like border trade shows, like showing how battle tested their smart fences are, and how they now have drones that can drop gas canisters and smoke bombs all over folks. There's just a diverse menu of technology that is designed to torment people, keep them subjugated, keep the unwanted away from their pristine sort of way of living. And that's, the U.S. saw that, obviously, and went to like whoever the world leader was at the time. And it's clearly been Israel. So by far, like the largest market for border security technology is the U.S. government. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think the one that I remember is like in 2018, I think that number reached $40 billion. And this is what's precipitated the militarization of our border. Like not only have we, Operation Gatekeeper doubled the amount of border agents in the 90s that we have, but we've also like increased the amount of technology, like really, really high tech technology that's on these borders. Saying that our borders need to be militarized, and that protects our way of life is like just as much of a farce as like, George W. Bush telling, Americans that Al Qaeda attacked us on 9/11 because they hate our freedom. It's that manufactured in terms of like the messaging.
What would you say? Are there any similarities in way the, you brought up border militarization. Is there any ways in which the border is being policed that is very similar to the way in which the police or military operates in terms of controlling the movement of people or the borders of Palestine?
Yeah, definitely. There's certainly a lot of like the capabilities of these technologies are designed to have the same effect. So you have, like placement of border patrol agents, like directly on the borderline with these satellite patrol stations. You've got like basically concentrating all this technology along the border. So the technology is stuff like the sensors and the surveillance and like aircraft support, having eyes and ears on the border at all times. And it keeps it so that absolutely nobody can come close to it. And you basically create a system of monitoring, detaining and incarcerating people that are like moving through it or moving close to it, right? So it definitely feeds into like an incarceration strategy and a detention strategy and potentially like an information extraction strategy as well. And then the other like really crazy thing about all this is like they just treat the border like it's a hardened line that like if you cross this line you die. It's all this stuff's really complex. Like at the end of the day, like that is what we're talking about here. Like cross this line and you die. It's just a sort of never ending battle for like this front line to like quote unquote secure our people. Right. I think that's like the pervasive thing that ends up, getting like the public to consent to, the militarization of our border. Right. It's just fear tactics. So like perceiving and propagandizing immigrants as like an inherent enemy to everyday Americans. This is the type of thing that Israel has been doing for such a long time. They're like, there's no way a Palestinian can get along with you or understand or accept your way of life. Like there, anybody who comes close to the border is coming to hurt you and your family, rip you out of your home and tell you that you don't belong here, So I think that's where you see some of like the parallels that go beyond just like the technology piece of it. It's a lot of like the propaganda and fear mongering. That's so like, it's what allows the public to like buy into stuff like this.
And I mean, especially like if you look at like far right media, they have, you know, just off the wall conspiracy theories of ISIS sleeper cells working with, you know, Mexican drug cartels and so on and so forth. I mean, maybe the best example of that in recent times was that there was this one guy on the border, some sort of like kind of militia guy that was really known for like kind of producing and putting forward like false conspiracy theories. But he found this homeless camp that had been abandoned, and he claimed that it was like a Mexican drug cartel child sex ring, or evidence of one. And he was trying to get the border patrol and like militias to come down there and like investigate it. And even InfoWars put out something saying like, this guy's full of it, which shows you
when InfoWars calls you out,
you got too far. But you brought up Operation Gatekeeper, which was, passed in 1994 at the same time that NAFTA was passed through, the North American Free Trade Agreement. So at the same time as the United States was basically expanding a quote unquote free trade zone, which, you know, dramatically changed the economies of both the U.S. and Mexico, took land away from people in Mexico, basically forced people into different ways of making money, causing people to migrate into the United States to look for work. You know, they put into place this Operation Gatekeeper program, which further militarized the border. So I'm just curious, you know, now there's so much talk of, you know, Trump's wall and if it's not getting built or if it is getting built, and just kind of talking about that. But in reality, the Democrats and just kind of the state and its daily operation, like, is more and more militarizing the border, kind of very much outside of the mainstream media spotlight, while everything kind of gets talked about is just Trump's wall. So I'm just curious, you know, your thoughts on that. Just kind of like the further militarization of the border that really isn't being talked about, that's kind of like missing outside of the discussion that's just like all encapsulated by Trump.
Yeah, I think that's really common, where you get like these Democrats who oppose the wall, but like end up on the back end, like making concessions, like, oh, we'll increase the amount of border patrol that are in the area. Oh, we'll increase the, technologies and, you know, partner with, you know, that sort of gives the green light to like a lot of these generals and DHS to like partner with groups like Elbit, because it sounds, you know, partnering with a system like Elbit and IFT Tower sounds a lot more humane than like, you know, putting up a wall. But at the end of the day, like, what are the effects of like even this invisible sort of high tech wall? The effects are that like folks who are migrating like through like end up, their journeys become a lot more perilous, because they're like they're skirted outside of these areas, and then they can be detected like in a way that's a lot more immediate, and they can like sort of bring helicopters down on them and create these traumatic, horrible events. You know, according to Border Patrol, like 6,000 people have died trying to cross the border since 1990s. And that's according to the Border Patrol. I mean, that's probably a very conservative estimate of like what the death toll is. So like the blood is on the hands of like everyone, like the tech giants that I'm talking about, like Elbit, like the Democrats who are like okay with just militarizing the border as opposed to like, say, a wall, you know, like that's the battle that they're not fighting much of a battle. They're just like, if I just oppose Trump on this, then I'll look good and I'll look humane. But the reality on the ground, like, as, you know, groups like No More Deaths, like, show us, you know, when they go out there, you know, is that these things persist, and they actually make the desert, which is already like a really, you know, treacherous place to make such a journey. Like, it makes them that all that much more treacherous. And the other thing is like, not just with migrants, like the indigenous peoples who live in these places, you know, specifically Tohono O'odham, like they've inhabited an enormous area of land in the Southwest for forever. And, you know, the boundary between the U.S. and Mexico cuts not only through like desert terrain and like all this wilderness, but also into like these indigenous territories. So like the ways that they migrate, like whether it be like tradition, ceremonial, like are also halted as well, and they become like people who are surveyed as a result of these towers. So, you know, just because the wall is obviously something we should all oppose, but like at the end of the day, like it's the wall you can't see that is like also like the real killer in a lot of it, in a lot of these situations.
Well, I think this kind of brings us to another interesting question, in that, you know, how do we kind of navigate the contradiction between the U.S. needing cheap migrant labor on one hand, and also making it harder and harder for migrants to enter the country? I mean, this is everything from like making it harder to quote unquote, you know, migrate legally, to, you know, everything we've been talking about in terms of border enforcement. You know, how do we resolve this contradiction? Is it both that they want to like make it harder for people to move and they want to, you know, more police, but at the same time, they also recognize they still need migrants to make the system work?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how they like square this away in their heads, just because it's just not ever the way that I like think about these things. You know, I think perhaps they think that there's already enough like quote unquote like folks who they deem to be like doing, to be like the types of people who are going to do that work, like are already here, and what we need to do is just like put a cap on it because there's already like way too many undesirable migrants like in the country. I mean, that might be one way they're looking at it. I'm not entirely sure, but like in terms of like Palestine, there is a connection there too, because like there's a lot of parallels to like labor in Palestine as well, because the Palestinian economy has been so you know, devastated by the occupation, by a lot of these like machinations that I've been talking about, that like a lot of Palestinians end up like taking up construction work in Israel that like literally thefts and robs their land, you know, where they're like working on the very things that are like keeping them out. And obviously that's a very humiliating like experience, but at the end of the day, these people have to survive, you know, and it's, the situation is so dire. So I think there's a lot of like, solidarity and connection between like being in that type of like predicament where you have to sort of perpetuate what you hate in order to survive, you know? And obviously that could be even a psychological game that like, you know, the occupier plays with folks in order to normalize everything.
You know, I wanted to ask too, you know, recently there's been an uncovering of the fact that a lot of Border Patrol have been involved in these kind of like secret Facebook groups where they've been trading like racist memes and articles and stuff like that. How would you say that compares to what you know about kind of like the rank and file like IDF soldiers in Palestine and just how they kind of view the people that they're policing on the Palestinian side?
The IDF has like it's not a voluntary service. Like everyone has to serve in the IDF. Once they turn 18 for at least like a couple of years. So and there's exceptions to that. If you're like very religious, there's like exceptions. But it's, you know, men and women, obviously. So, I think in some ways, like the culture in Israel is like, because everybody knows someone who served or served themselves, and they don't all serve in like military, like on the ground roles. I mean, obviously there's so much like administrative and like sort of monitoring like social media, like what you're talking about, sort of like, you know, that type of like psychological sort of like operations. So I mean, in a lot of ways, there's just like a huge, massive, you know, acceptance and reverence for everyone who serves in the military, because they feel like everyone has a stake. Despite it being a military that has basically like the lowest, among the lowest in the world of like actual casualties and injuries and anything, just because they're such a Goliath, right? But, you know, your gender, I think it's probably diverse. Like I'm sure there's your IDF who are like, you know, absolute. I mean, in my opinion, like it's, they're sort of like all held captive to like, the occupation. I mean, they're the foot soldiers of the occupation. And I think the way that they utilize soldiers in certain ways is like really horrible. Like, for example, you know, when I was in that part of the world, not that long, like last summer, like I noticed when I was going through checkpoints with like my family and stuff like that, a lot of like the people, the IDF that were at the checkpoints or like people of color, like even a lot of Arabs. Like I was looking at their name tags and I was seeing names like Muhammad and Hassan and stuff like that. I'm like, these are Arab names. I'm looking at Arab faces. Like I'm Arab. I know what they look like. You know what I mean? So it's like interesting that they put those folks on the front lines because they like, they speak Arabic. They look like us. And perhaps there's like sort of a psychological, aspect to doing that aside from like a practical one that they can like speak Arabic and sort of like, you know, be a little more familiar or something like that. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know a lot of IDF myself. I've met a few, like, especially like reformed IDF who like opposed occupation now. And, they all say the same thing that like Israel can't sustain itself without a, you know, compulsory, army buy-in from everybody. So, you know, I'm not entirely sure. If you look at something like the Great March of Return, which has been happening for the last over a year, where, you know, brave Palestinians are going to like what is not a border, it's just like a line in the dirt that Israeli snipers hide behind, and are getting picked off by snipers, like men, women, children, medics, media, what have you, like intentionally like picked off by IDF snipers. And there's video of like IDF celebrating. And then you have like, you know, villages, you know, illegal Israeli settlements that have a lot of IDF living there, where they sort of camp out and drink beers and watch like bombs rain on Gaza. And, you know, a culture that literally has like, you know, the choices between Netanyahu and, the Blue and White Party. Like, I don't see a culture that is opposed to the occupation. I don't see a culture that is critical of the IDF. I don't see a culture that's interested in a one-state solution or a two-state solution. They're interested in perpetuating this occupation until it puts a stranglehold on Palestinians in a way that they can't resist anymore. I don't have a particularly positive view of the IDF. You know, I see them all as obviously complicit in like these horrendous occupation.
Well, one last question I have is that, you know, looking at this state structure and how it interacts with the media and kind of the messages and narrative that it puts out, do you see any similarities? Like, how does kind of the state kind of like explain to the population or kind of like massage its own talking points to the greater population about how it controls the day-to-day lives of Palestinian people? And does that compare with like what the state does here?
It totally does. I mean, it's all fear-based, right? It's all like, you know, if any of them cross that line, that's it. You're like, the life that you love and enjoy is over. It's certainly that type of fear-mongering of the other. It's a way to separate the two cultures from actually coming to see each other as humans and understand ways in which these two folks can live peacefully, because neither group of people is going anywhere anytime soon, you know? And I think, you know, it's been so dominated by mostly right-wing, center-right-wing parties and rulers and leaders throughout this time that, like, it shifted so much of the populace into this insanely reactionary view. I mean, it's, like, part of the reason why Trump is so, like, glorified in Israel. They named a settlement after him after, you know, he announced the Golan Heights, gifted the Golan Heights to Israel as if it was his gift. So yeah, there's so many similarities. I mean, that fear-mongering is obviously a big part, but then there's the way that they sort of describe their posture to like, even like the liberal media here is often like to like make groups like Hamas a boogeyman, right? To say like, we have to snipe these medics and these kids because, you know, Hamas is using them as human shields. So it's all these like, it's just every tactic you can imagine to justify what is completely unjustifiable. So the Israeli sort of military, intelligence and propaganda wing is like notorious. Like if you've ever like gone into a comment section on anything remotely like pro-Palestinian, you will know what I'm talking about. And I hate to sort of analyze things from the lens of a comment section, but it's like, I think there's something to be said there, you know? there's definitely a troll army that is unleashed, like, to really control the narrative. And what is already, in terms of popular American media, like, it's already a controlled narrative. So it's these spaces on the internet and free media that they're trying to, like, go after now.
Well, is there anything else that you want to talk about or mention? Are there any resources that you want people to follow? Definitely tell us how to check out your group and how to follow their work. But any other things that maybe that people can continue down this rabbit hole on?
Yeah, for sure. So, like, our group, you know, we have two chapters in Phoenix and Tucson. So if you want to plug in with us, like, we'd be happy to have you. A lot of our group is actually just people who organize another scenes, but have like a particular eye towards Palestine. So it's, you know, we have tons of folks from like No More Deaths that organize in APSA because, you know, they're out there on the border, like seeing these IFT towers, they're able to put it together. A lot of like anti-war and anti-militarization folks, you know, like PSL, folks like that. But you know, the thing that I would just sort of like conclude with is like, I think it's super important to just recognize the inherent sort of third world solidarity that exists between indigenous peoples in the borderlands, migrants that are coming over, you know, those that oppose U.S. invasion and imperialism on like a broad level, not just in support of Israel. And then Palestinians, you know, who exist in a state of total militarization that's installed by Israel and that the U.S. basically guarantees. In terms of like questions to ask ourselves, I would just like say, you know, how do we as individuals, maybe as activists and as activist communities, like how do we engage in activities that are both big and small that reduce global support to, you know, Israel's sort of border militarization complex? And then if you like broaden that question a little bit, like if you're a working person in the U.S., like you got to ask yourself that same question, like how do I engage in activities that reduce global support to the American military machine? Because if you do that, you're by extension going to reduce it for Israelis. And I know we talked about BDS a little bit in our last conversation. I will just say, like, you know, try and fight through a lot of the propaganda that's the propaganda war that's against BDS and understand BDS for like what it truly is. Like, it's really only when you isolate states like pariah states like Israel on a world stage that you're going to get them to actually like take a look in the mirror a little more, right? So we're certainly supporters of BDS, and you know, that's a very compelling movement that's happening right now that I think has a lot of legs.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.